This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International and the first woman and the first Asian to hold this position. Irene has received several prestigious awards for her leadership in human rights and her work to end violence against women, including the Sydney Peace Prize in 2006. Irene Khan is here today to tell us about her book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton & Company. Welcome to the Sustainability Segment.
Thank you for inviting me.
What led you to write your book, The Unheard Truth?
Well, I have been working on human rights and humanitarian issues now for 30 years. I was a refugee worker for 21 years and with Amnesty now for 9 years. And the more I delve into the issue of human rights, the more I realize how human rights abuses actually impoverish people and keep them poor, and how an empowering agenda could help people come out of that state of poverty. And that eventually, my own life, I wasn't born poor, but I do come from a poor country. My own background, as well as my work, led me to write this book.
What are the drawbacks to defining poverty in terms of income?
Well, the problem with defining poverty as income is that it doesn't give you the full picture. If you ask people living in poverty what their life is like, of course they are deprived of many basic needs and material goods, but they will also tell you about the insecurity in which they live, the crime in the neighborhoods, the police violence that they sometimes confront, the conflicts and wars in which many poor people are thrown into. They will tell you about the discrimination they face, discrimination because they're poor, but also discrimination that has forced them to become poor if, for example, they're indigenous people or sometimes women, single women or people of color. So there is discrimination, there is insecurity, but most importantly, poor people will tell you how they're not heard, they're shut out, they're excluded, they don't count very often. That's what they will tell you. So for me, poverty is not just about how much you earn. Poverty is about discrimination, insecurity, exclusion, voicelessness, marginalization. These are human rights problems.
If you look worldwide, to what extent has economic growth helped the poor?
Well, economic growth has lifted, we are told by economists, has lifted millions of people out of poverty. But economic growth has also created inequality. We are living in a world that is more unequal today than ever before. Many people have been pushed out of the system, you know, thrown out of economic systems. You have companies moving into areas, oil companies, for example, building oil pipelines. It benefits some people, but other people are being displaced. So economic growth helps some people, but it also marginalizes many others. And the question that my book keeps asking is, who is being left behind? Counting the marginalized is a very political issue. And therefore, the powerful don't want to do that. And we constantly have to keep asking, who's being left behind?
Would you say more about if you look at the poorest members of society and how they are doing in countries where economic growth is taking place? What is generally found?
Well, let's look at China. A lot of people hold up China as the great success story of economic growth. Now, in China, the inequality factor is about 1 to 30. In the United States, it's 1 to 16. In China, there's huge difference between people living along the coast, people living in rural areas, people who have legal status in the cities, and migrants who don't have any legal status. So there are big, big differences that have come up as a result of the economic growth in China. And there is absolutely no means for people to protest. So from time to time, there are rural unrest. We don't hear about it much outside China. But to me, it seems that there is a pressure cooker building up there.
You alluded to this earlier, but would you highlight the specific human rights issues that lie at the center of poverty?
Well, the human rights problems that lie at the center of poverty have to do very much with both civil and political rights. That means poor people whose voice is not being heard. If they try to organize themselves, they get thrown into prison. We've seen that happening with indigenous people who protest the forcible displacement from their lands. But at the same time, we also see with poor people that their economic and social rights are not recognized as rights. They are seen as commodities. Healthcare, for example, even in this country, there is over 40 million people who have no healthcare. It's the only developed nation in the world that has such a large number of people with no healthcare. Healthcare is a human right, and it's the poor who suffer when they don't have healthcare.
Would you say more about the way in which human rights abuses help to create and perpetuate poverty? Some examples.
Some real examples. Take, for example, conflict societies. If you look at Africa, look at some of the wealthiest countries in Africa. And I say wealthy because they're resource-rich countries. Countries like Equatorial Guinea or Angola or Sudan or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Very rich in mineral, oil, and other such natural resources. Yet the people in those countries are some of the poorest, and those countries have also been plunged into internal conflict and war for decades. And that's because of the exploitative nature of the economic system there. You have corrupt governments colluding with large international business and basically pushing people out of it. The benefits that they get out of that business don't go to the people. In Chad, for instance, which is a country with rich in oil and other minerals, agreements have been made for a pipeline to be built. The World Bank did a deal with the Chadian government saying that money gained from there would go for the benefit of the people. The government ignored that agreement and actually used that money to buy arms. And when the World Bank pulled out, the French government went in and supported the Chadian government. The companies, private companies, came in and did deals with the Chadian government. So basically, the Chadian government continues to deprive people of the resources of their country. And the result of that is actually conflict. There is armed conflict and violence inside Chad between the rebels and the government. So no one wins in that game.
Would you like to give an additional example of how human rights abuses help to create and perpetuate poverty?
Well, other examples abound. For instance, if we look at, say, for example, Mexico. Now, in Mexico, what happened was interesting because in Ciudad Juarez, we are all very familiar with Ciudad Juarez these days because of the violence that's taking place. Now, in Ciudad Juarez, women have come from all over Mexico to work in the maquilas. These are the assembly plants. These are women coming from the poorest parts of Mexico to improve their livelihood, and many of them earn more. In Ciudad Juarez, they go to night school to improve their education levels, but then they are killed. They disappear. No one cares. The police didn't prosecute. The authorities didn't investigate. And the women, when I met them some years ago, they said to me, our voices don't count. We just don't count because we are poor women. And yet these women have helped build the economy of Ciudad Juarez.
In your book, you speak about the way that deprivation, insecurity, exclusion, and voicelessness are an interlocking web that keeps people in poverty. Would you explain?
I think the issue here is that each of these problems, deprivation, discrimination, insecurity, voicelessness, reinforced each other into a downward spiral. Take, for example, women in some countries who don't have the right to own land. When their husband dies in the village, many of these women face a lot of oppression at the hands of their husband's families. So they pack their bags and they come into the cities. This happens in Bangladesh, in India, in Kenya, in many parts of the world. And in the slums of the large cities in these countries, you will find women. Now, these women are then exploited by the system in the slum, by the slum lords who demand very high rents, by employers who sometimes want sexual favors from them in order to give them a job. And of course, these women, being poor women living in slums, are discriminated because they are poor. And so you see them going from one troubled situation into another and being driven down into deeper and deeper poverty, from which it is very difficult for them to uplift themselves unless there is an empowering environment. And where we've seen change coming has been when organizations have moved in to provide them with microcredit, to help them organize themselves, to teach them some skills. Then you see women's groups emerging, you see women working together, setting up small business, you see small signs of hope.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International and author of the book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak now about how the mortality of women in childbirth reflects human rights abuse and the link to poverty?
Well, one of the saddest facts in our world today is that 500,000 women, die every year of childbirth or pregnancy-related reasons. That is a woman dying every minute. Most of these women die because they don't have access to medical care, because the medical system is not geared to provide health care for women. It's a discriminatory medical system. It is also a discriminatory social system in which women don't have a say. They don't decide when they're going to get married. Many of them are married at a very young age and become pregnant before they have fully developed their own bodies. They don't have a say on whether or not they should get pregnant, how they space their children. I was in Sierra Leone 3 weeks ago, where women in the rural areas are treated as minors, as children. They are not the ones who have the authority to decide to go to the clinic. And of course, most importantly for all in many of these countries, who decides how much of the national budget will be spent on maternal health? These decisions are not being made by women. And of course, many of these women are subject to violence, violence during pregnancy, violence in the form of female genital cutting, which can severely affect their ability to have healthy pregnancies, and other forms of violence as well. So you see a cycle in which the discrimination, the insecurity, or the violence with which these women live, their lives are simply not valued. And that's one of the key factors for this very high rate of maternal death. The global figure of maternal death hasn't budged since 1992. Yet we've seen over the last decade huge progress, economic growth that we were talking about earlier. None of that growth seems to have made a dent on maternal deaths.
In your book, you speak about the fragmentation of rights that has taken place historically, the economic, social, and cultural rights on the one hand, and the civil and political rights on the other. Why has this fragmentation occurred, and what has been the effect?
Well, you know, the irony is that most policymakers would agree with me about the definition of poverty being a definition that includes human rights abuses. But the reason why there is reluctance to incorporate human rights into development is twofold. On the one hand, there are many who don't recognize economic and social rights. The United States is one such country where healthcare is not seen as a human right, for instance. Yet, it is ironical that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948, the key architect of that declaration was Eleanor Roosevelt, and it was her husband who talked about freedom from want and freedom from fear. And at that time, in 1948, the United States recognized this unified vision of human rights because they had just come out of the Depression. After that, however, the Cold War settled in, and so you had socialist countries supporting economic and social rights and Western democracies supporting civil and political rights. And that led to a bifurcation of human rights. That has been extremely debilitating because it's not a holistic view. When I have been in Darfur talking to rape survivors, they have told me they want justice, they want protection, but they also want health care. So they want civil and political rights, but they also want economic and social rights. From the perspective of the individual, human rights have to be approached holistically. But from the perspective of politics, human rights seems to have been fragmented.
Would you speak about Amnesty International's own journey from focusing on civil and political rights to including economic and social rights?
Well, Amnesty International was born in 1961, and at that time, it was the height of the Cold War, and Amnesty decided that it would work to release prisoners of conscience. These are people who have been imprisoned because of their belief, political opinion, religious belief, or other kinds of belief. So Amnesty, for all sorts of reasons at that time, focused on a number of civil and political rights. And over time, this was seen as somehow prioritizing one set of rights over another. Amnesty is a very large human rights organization, the world's largest human rights organization. So when we focused simply on a few rights, it was seen by others as though we were deprioritizing economic and social rights. And the more we began our work with refugees and migrants, with civilians in armed conflict, and then with women and gender-based violence, we recognized that we need to focus on a whole range of rights because that's the way people's experience plays out. Human rights are not just about text, it's about people's life experience. So we decided, Amnesty is a democratically organized, membership-based organization. Amnesty's members decided that the organization needed to move on. The organization works for the forgotten prisoner. And we today recognize that the forgotten prisoner is not always behind prison bars. It can be a woman suffering violence in her home. It can be a man living in a slum with no security of tenure. It can be indigenous people who are being pushed off their lands. So that's how Amnesty moved on to launch a global campaign to stop violence against women, and now to launch a campaign to address those very severe, egregious human rights abuses that keep people poor.
To what extent has the international community as a whole taken human rights into account in addressing poverty?
The international community as a whole would agree on the theory, but there's a big gap between their rhetoric and what they actually do in practice. And that is partly because, as I said earlier, some governments would not recognize economic and social rights as full rights. It is also because there are some governments who believe that in order to promote development, you have to suppress liberty. If you take China as an example of the latter argument, and in China, the government will say, in order for their development, they need to restrict people's free speech. They need to restrict the internet. They need to restrict people's right to assemble or to build trade unions, for example. Now, in my book, I've looked at data, and I have not found any data to show that China's economic development in any way has been helped by suppression of civil rights. There is nothing to suggest that if China had pursued democratic means, that it would not have gained the same degree of economic development. So for me, it's a false argument. On the contrary, when you suppress civil liberties, you increase tensions, you have government that is not transparent, and you have terrible outcomes. Think of the great famine in China.
How well do the Millennium Development Goals take human rights into account in addressing poverty?
The Millennium Development Goals have helped to focus the international community on certain issues, such as halving poverty, cutting down maternal mortality, cutting down infant mortality. What they don't include, however, is a rights-based approach. And what I mean about that is that they don't require governments to report on who is being left behind. The reports are aggregates. So if you look at countries, you may see them making great progress. But if you were to ask, well, what's your figure for maternal mortality in the rural areas, you would actually find that is much, much worse than it would seem. China, for instance, has a huge discrepancy between maternal health in the cities and in the villages. So discrimination is ignored by the Millennium Development Goals. The second factor is the Millennium Development Goals don't recognize empowerment of people. Experience shows empowerment of people is the way out of poverty. They don't recognize that. They're simply looking at outcomes. So you miss out something there. Thirdly, they don't recognize participation of people or even accountability of governments. So development is seen as a top-down process rather than a bottom-up process. And that is why most of the goals will not be reached in the time frame that the UN has set.
Do you see a way of correcting that lack?
Certainly, there is a way of correcting it. I think the first way of correcting that would be to include an obligation on governments to report disaggregated data. That means a breakdown of men and women, ethnic minorities, rural and urban, and that will show you the real picture of where good work is being done that can be praised, but work that is not being done that needs to be corrected. The other element would be to include participation of people as a right in the goals. Human rights have to be seen as a breakthrough strategy for development. That means the what is in the Millennium Development Goals. The how has to be through human rights. And that needs to be recognized and incorporated in the goals.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International and author of the book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights. Would you give some additional examples of how a human rights perspective has helped in solving the problem of poverty?
Well, let's take the situation in India, where some years ago, some factory workers in Rajasthan, in western India, wanted to know how many hours they were being paid for. And when they asked from their government officials, they were told, from the factory, it was a government-run factory, and they were told that was a state secret. They began a movement which led to freedom of information legislation in India. Now, using that freedom of information legislation, now you can see villagers going to the village leaders and asking about food distribution, about money that is coming in for health and education. And you can see local people taking ownership of the development process, and that has made government more open and development more effective. There is another example in my book about slum dwellers in Cebu City in the Philippines. And there the government was investing in city development, demolishing slums, pushing people out, building new homes, which were just too far away from where people were working. The local groups organized themselves, set up a local housing association, trained local judges that were dealing with evictions, and helped the local city to set up actually a different kind of housing policy that was more responsive to the needs of the people. So these are two examples, grassroots up, that show how development can be made more relevant.
Overall, how effective have legal approaches been to ending world poverty through addressing human rights?
Well, law is meant to protect people. Human rights law is seen as a tool for protecting people. But in actual practice, very often, law ignores the poor. There are millions of poor children who are never registered at birth because the system is too complicated for the parents to understand. Sometimes there are laws that actually criminalize the poor, take vagrancy laws. In San Francisco, in 1 year, 43,000 people receive citations for sleeping out in parks. So the law is not always helping the poor. However, there is a movement that has developed from grassroots up again, alternative legal lawyers, for instance, that provide paralegal assistance to the poor, that help them figure out how the law works, that helps lobby for change of laws. And in many countries, you're seeing great changes being brought about as a result of that. In my own country, in Bangladesh, groups have helped landless peasants reclaim land from big business by supporting them and by helping them to go to court and fight their cases.
To what extent do we need to address accountability for human rights across borders, looking particularly at the responsibility of corporations that are working in developing countries?
Well, one of the challenges, I think, of the modern economy, of course, is that decisions that affect your life, say as a poor farmer or a poor worker in Nigeria, might be made by oil companies whose headquarters are in New York or London. So your ability to influence that process is very little if you're a poor man in Nigeria. And that's why in the book I'm looking at the role that companies play and arguing that in the modern economy, human rights obligations don't only rest on the government, they also rest on companies. And we have to find and we have to set international standards that hold companies responsible. And we have to find mechanisms by which companies can be pursued across the border in other places, because sometimes these companies are operating in weak states or in corrupt states where the government has no interest in prosecuting the company. But people can't be left without a remedy. They should be able to prosecute these companies where they're headquartered, where their wealth is, and get justice.
What kind of progress has been made in holding companies responsible?
Not enough, I would say, not enough. Take Bhopal and the disaster that took place in the 80s there, where an American company actually was responsible for that disaster. 20 years later, 25 years later, people are still suffering from health problems. Even the environment where that chemical disaster took place hasn't been cleaned up. And there's been no justice for the people. No one's been prosecuted. And that company was using health and safety regulations or health and safety standards in India that it was not using in its own plant in the United States. And the Indian government was too weak and not ready, basically reluctant to sue that company in India because it needed the business. And so the company got away with it. And you have young girls today who are suffering from gynecological problems, who are giving birth to deformed babies because of the damage to their health when they were children 20 years ago.
In the context of a human rights perspective, what are the key steps we should take to eradicate poverty?
I think the most important step is to recognize that the issue here is empowerment of the people. And that means recognizing the rights of people living in poverty, their dignity, and therefore giving them a voice. They need to participate in the development process. That's respect for their civil and political rights. Alongside that must be the recognition of health, education, housing as economic and social rights. I think once there is that recognition of economic and social rights and the recognition that people have to be empowered, then you create a different debate, a different discourse around poverty.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope my book will change the debate on poverty and human rights. I hope my book will convince people that no matter what strategy they follow to eradicate poverty, if they don't put human rights at the center of it, it's not going to succeed.
And what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message I want to leave your listeners with is actually in the last paragraph of my book, where I talk about the great momentous events of history, the emancipation of women, the abolition of slavery, and the ending of apartheid. And I say that each one of those movements had at its core the belief on human rights, that each individual is endowed with human rights because they are human, the universality of human rights. And to me, poverty is as important a struggle as was the end of apartheid or the ending of slavery. And I believe that we can end poverty if we put justice and freedom at its heart.
Well, thanks so much for being here. We have just been speaking with Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International and author of the book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton & Company. For more information, check on the web at www.amnesty.org. That's amnesty.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.